Brian Curtis.
And I'm Wendy Ring. Welcome to Cool Solutions, stories of climate action from the bottom up. In July 2020, Vermont became the first state in the U.S. to ban all food waste from landfills.
That's a big deal because landfills emit methane, and deep reductions in methane are essential to slow global warming over the next decade and keep temperature rise under 1.5 degrees Celsius.
Methane has two qualities that make it very different from carbon dioxide. One, it's a super pollutant with 80 times the warming impact of carbon dioxide. Two, its life in the atmosphere is short. While carbon dioxide sticks around for hundreds of years, methane is gone in 12.
So if we stop emitting methane, in little more than a decade, that powerful warming force would be gone.
The top three ways that humans emit methane. All right, you juveniles, it's not what you're thinking.
You juveniles.
What I'm talking about is animal agriculture, cow burps and manure, oil and gas production, and landfills. And the biggest source of methane in landfills is decomposing food.
So keeping food out of landfills is key for the climate, especially when it can feed hungry people or play a role in natural carbon removal.
The conventional food system model is linear and is styled after a factory production model from fertilizer factory to landfill.
That's Tom Gilbert, owner and operator of Black Dirt Farm in Stannard, Vermont. For 25 years, he's been farming in a way that bucks that factory paradigm.
Our whole business model and farm operations are designed to follow the carbon cycle. We try to mimic an ecosystem. So we collect discarded food, about 30 tons a week from over 90 businesses, schools, and other generators. We bring that back here. We blend it up into a compost recipe. And the first thing we do is forage a flock of 1,200 laying hens on that material. And what they don't eat, we run through a herd of worms and make worm castings, which is basically worm manure, which is sold mostly to the bagged retail market. And then on the back end of everything, we grow crops. So we do about 40 acres of hay and grow a small number of produce crops.
Tom and everyone else we talked to said the landfill ban didn't just happen overnight. As they tell it, the story really began in the late 1980s. In March 1987, a barge carrying over 3,000 tons of trash left Long Island bound for North Carolina. The local landfill was full, and a facility in Morehead City, North Carolina, had agreed to accept the New York garbage and turn it into methane.
But while the barge was en route, a rumor spread that some of the trash on board contained hospital gowns, syringes, and diapers. The load was rejected in North Carolina, so the barge kept going, searching for a place to dump this giant mound of trash.
As it traveled south down the Atlantic coast and then east across the Gulf Coast, six states turned up their noses at the smelly cargo.
The Mexican Navy blocked the barge's entrance into Mexican waters.
It was refused a berth in Belize and turned away from the Bahamas.
In the end, what the media took to calling the Gar Barge, still carrying its by now extremely aromatic load of trash, returned to New York, where after a journey of 6 months and 6,000 miles, the garbage was incinerated in Brooklyn.
This traveling load of trash gained such notoriety that it sparked a wave of solid waste legislation around the country.
In Vermont, the legislature passed a bill that same year closing down hundreds of town dumps that were to be replaced with new lined sanitary landfills and setting a goal that by 2005, half the materials entering the solid waste stream would instead be reduced, reused, or recycled.
But 2005 came and went, and the 50% diversion goal was never met. By 2012, Vermont was running out of places to put its trash. There were only two landfills left in the state, one nearly full and the other on the verge of closure.
It was past time to admit that the recycling law wasn't working.
It was a voluntary prescription. It basically said recycling is good. We want to have more recycling in Vermont, and we would encourage the private sector to do more of it. You know, I think what we learned is that you can't achieve anything setting vague goals that just ask for people to voluntarily comply is not an adequate answer to big problems like climate change or even white supremacy. These are not things that you can simply, you know, suggest. You have to really approach them structurally. As 2005 was coming and going and the state was nowhere close to its recycling goals, we were at 32% in 2005. There was a lot of agitation at the ground level and increasing organizing.
work that people were doing on other parts of the food system was starting to converge.
I had a vision for trying to develop this highly decentralized, distributed organics recycling model for Vermont that would tie into the food system. And that was sort of falling on deaf ears in the policy space. And so the organization that I ran at the time, the Highfield Center for Composting, started working on a program we called Close the Loop Vermont. Our goal was to end run the policy side of things and just start building that infrastructure, regardless of political support. We were rolling out community composting programs around Vermont, building infrastructure, developing markets, developing hauling programs, educating, training, certifying composting operators on farms. And then Vermont's food system movement really coalesced around a program called Farm to Plate. And what emerged from that was a statewide strategic plan for the food system.
With the goal of bending that factory-based linear food system, where resources go in and garbage comes out, into a self-sustaining circle in a way that was beyond voluntary, something with statutory and regulatory teeth.
The result was the Universal Recycling Act, which came before the Vermont legislature in 2012.
It took a lot of work. There was a lot of meetings, there was a lot of hearings, there was a lot of testimony, there was a lot of delivering reports, but it was a moment of what felt like very shared vision at all of the different levels between the community and farmer and grassroots side of things up to the state. There wasn't really a lot of conflict, more the legislators needed to just get updated and educated because they didn't have their hands on where we were with things. And when they were able to hear that we were quite far along with things like infrastructure development, once their anxieties about how it would actually work were addressed, it wasn't the hardest sell. I've spent a lot of time in the State House, and that was one of the more gratifying things to work on.
The bill passed unanimously, and it's now officially against the law in Vermont to send food waste, yard waste, and recyclables to the landfill.
Josh Kelly is the guy in Vermont's Department of Environmental Conservation responsible for implementing the landfill ban.
The landfill ban literally says in statute, no person shall knowingly dispose of these materials by these dates in landfill.
If there is a facility within 20 miles that will accept it.
Essentially, it's the field of dreams. If somebody builds a facility, then you must come along, is the basic policy mechanism.
Also written into the law is an official state food recovery hierarchy, directing discarded food to its highest and best use.
Prioritizing the best use first, all the way down. The highest is to not waste it in the first place. And the second is to donate for people in need.
Then feed it to animals. After that is composting, returning organic material to the land as fertilizer, and the last is energy production.
This is a good time to insert a little explanation about why it's better to put food waste in a compost pile than a landfill. Santana Vergara is an assistant professor of environmental engineering at Humboldt State University.
Both in the landfill and in the compost, you're starting with the same stuff. Essentially, you're starting with a lot of organic waste. And in both places, microbes are eating it up. There's a whole branch of microbes that can handle living without oxygen. They can decompose waste without oxygen, and they release methane. And then there's this whole other branch of bacteria that do need oxygen to live, just like we do. And so when they're decomposing, they're releasing CO2 instead. The big difference is that in a composting pile, there's oxygen available. Whereas in a landfill, you have the degradation happening in the absence of oxygen, so you're getting methane released instead, which is this much more powerful gas. So a really important comparison to make between composting and landfilling isn't just that we reduce our emissions by a lot, which we do, but the other huge difference is that when we apply compost to land, we get more plant growth. So when we get more plant growth, we have more photosynthesis. Plants pull in carbon from the atmosphere and they turn that carbon into sugar, which they use part of for their own plant matter. But part of it goes out as little sugars that the plants are offering off of their roots, basically entices the growth of fungal matter as well as other bacteria that have a symbiotic relationship with the plant. And so they're basically trading off nutrients, which means that these plants are pulling carbon out of the atmosphere where we don't want it, and into their biomass, where we do want it, and eventually down into the soil, where we really would like it to be.
The food waste part of the Universal Recycling Act was implemented in stages, starting in 2014.
The largest generators, those that produce more than 2 tons of food waste per week, must separate that material if they're within 20 miles of a facility that is able to accept it, like a composting facility, an anaerobic digester. Those types of facilities are the trigger for having to separate that waste. The next year was 1 ton. 2016 was then a half ton. And then 2017 phased down to 1/3 of a ton per week.
Who produces a ton or 2 tons of food scraps?
Supermarkets are around the 1 ton mark or slightly greater. A hospital, some universities, especially large universities, can be at the 2 ton level easily. There are some hotels and resorts that are so busy year round that they are at 1 ton or more.
In 2015, when the limit went down to 1 ton, farm and grocery store donations to food pantries increased to the point where there was too much of a good thing. Natasha Duarte, director of the Composting Association of Vermont and chair of Farm to Plate's Food Cycle Coalition, says it's been a bumpy transition.
There was this huge influx all of a sudden into the charitable food system to often volunteer-run food shelves that don't have adequate refrigeration, or there wasn't the right distribution, or some places would have too much and other places wouldn't have enough. They were actually turning down donations because they were concerned that they wouldn't be able to distribute them in time, and they didn't have the capacity to then figure out what the heck were they going to do with all of these packaged organics if they went bad. So we've had to really develop the infrastructure that supports the charitable food system.
Vermont also got a head start on home food scraps by adopting statewide pay-as-you-throw.
Instead of a flat rate for garbage disposal, customers now pay by the bag or the can.
That measure was remarkably effective. In the town of Vernon, when two trash bags cost twice as much as one, the volume going to the landfill was cut in half.
The amount of food scraps collected in Brattleboro doubled. Recycling increased by 50%, and by 2018, the town had blown by that 50% goal and was diverting 64% of its waste stream.
Part of the state's job was getting the word out to the public. Some college students decided to help.
We had a group of UVM students create an anthropomorphic apple core called Scrappy. They actually had this apple core like riding a four-wheeler and like, doing all these Vermont things like hunting and stuff. It was pretty comical. We have a video. It uses real people from Vermont to put a human face on the food system itself.
For the great meals I can still make.
For the environment and my future.
For the land and my hard work.
For the money we save and the family we feed.
For compost to grow food and the landfills we won't need.
Vermont state law bans food scraps from the trash. Eat what you buy and compost the scraps. Let's scrap food waste.
We think of separating food scraps as something urban hipsters do, but Vermont proves that rural is not a barrier.
Having chickens that you feed your scraps to, or your own home pigs, or your two kennel dogs that you give them anything and they eat it, is not uncommon. Nor is backyard composting. We are a very big gardening culture.
Still, there was an influx of food waste that needed new places to go.
We had a small, medium, and large style regulatory framework that made it pretty easy to get started as a small composter.
Small facilities and farms composting less than 5,000 cubic yards a year don't have to get permitted as solid waste facilities.
Different arms of state government have silos, but those silos cross over. Agriculture and solid waste don't seem like they have a nexus until you start composting and realize that putting food back into the soil just makes sense because you're taking food out of the soil. If you're a pumpkin grower, you're mining your soil and selling it every single day with your pumpkins.
Chuck Wooster, who owns and runs Sunrise Farm in White River Junction, is one of the farmers who started composting community food waste.
It's a mixed farm, primarily organic vegetables, but also some pastured lamb, chicken, and of course, because it's Vermont, maple syrup.
Sunrise Farm is a CSA, community-supported agriculture.
People join in the spring, which is nice for us because they're sending us their money when we need it to buy seeds, hire people, things like that. And then we're all sharing in the risk together of whatever the growing season may hold. Probably a couple thousand people are eating our food every week. Everybody comes to our farm stand to pick up their vegetables. You sort of go through and you fill up your basket. And because people are coming to the farm already, starting this year, we had them also bring their food waste back with them, which has been a really neat way to kind of close the loop. Being part of the community is a really important part of what we're doing here. This is a great example of an ecosystem service that people can see, that they can participate in. And I think it helps them just understand why it's important to have local farms.
Composting wasn't new to Chuck.
We started pretty small. I had 12 families my first year. And we had a flock of sheep. So the winter manure from the sheep, we would compost it with our vegetable waste, and that became the fertility for the farm. We've been at this now for a little over 20 years. And what happened over time was the market for our vegetables grew rapidly, whereas the market for the meat did not. Partly that's because raising meat on pasture is much more expensive compared to industrial meat. As organic farmers, we do charge a premium, and people expect that, but it might be 1.5 or 2 times the price of vegetables in the supermarket, whereas meat might be 4 times more.
So the vegetable operation outgrew the manure supply.
In the back of my mind, I was thinking, you know, we're kind of getting away from the original idea here, which is use organic matter to feed the soil to grow your vegetables. And if we can't do that with animal manure, what are our other options?
The universal recycling law created a new opportunity.
For a lot of Vermont, the more rural parts, this is no big deal. They have a place on their property that they can just throw the food waste. Our town has about 10,000 people, and if everyone started throwing their food waste in the backyard, we would double or triple our resident raccoon and skunk and black bear population.
As the date of the final food ban got closer, food scrap hauling businesses started popping up. Here's Josh again.
I call them organics entrepreneurs. When an economy goes sour, people start their own businesses. What I've come to learn, middle of the summer of that global pandemic, and you have a food waste ban going into effect. One story is Zach Kavakis with Music Mountain Compost. He lost his job due to COVID, heard about this law, said, I can do that, started a collection route with his pickup truck with buckets, and now he's got his own compost site, and he collects from businesses, schools, residents. We estimate that when the law passed in 2012, there was about a dozen food scrap haulers in the state. We're now at 45. So we've more than tripled that number.
One of Chuck's CSA members also started a food scrap hauling business and is bringing that food to his farm.
We have a gentleman here who is a consultant on food scrap recycling, and the state paid him to help me figure out how to build the building and site the facility. So we got a lot of great technical support from the state. We take a couple of tons of food scraps from Gen every week, and our shareholders probably bring back another 0.5 ton. So it's really turned into kind of an important part of our business.
Chuck is taking us on a tour of his compost operation. It's an open pole and beam structure with a concrete pad and a shed roof covered with solar panels.
The first section is what they call the blending area. And this is where the raw food scraps get dropped and then covered either with sawdust or animal bedding or wood chips. The next section is the aerated static pile. The classic compost facilities, you sort of make a long windrow. And then after a couple of weeks, the pile will have used up all of its oxygen. So you use equipment to sort of flip the windrow over and keep the process going. It takes a fair bit of land, flat land. And so if you've got it, it's a really inexpensive way to compost food scrap.
Sunrise is a small farm, only 6 acres.
In our case, with limited space, we actually build a pile on top of an air pipe that has holes in it, and then we blow air through the pipe. And so what it means is we don't have to turn the compost during that active phase. We just lay this PVC pipe right down the middle. You can sort of straddle it with the tractor, and then you build a compost pile right on top of it. We have like a dryer hose between the fan and the pipe, and you turn on the timer, and away it goes. 80% of all the composting happens right there. We track the temperature and adjust the air to keep it in a sweet spot. Then we move the material out into the final section of the building, the curing area. The compost will sit there for 2 to 3 months, and then we can scoop it up from there to spread on our fields.
They didn't have to buy any new machinery.
We've got a couple of tractors, 60 horsepower, that are more than enough for the job. It doesn't even take a half an hour twice a week to dump the buckets, look for stray debris, and then drive over to the building and mix in some wood chips. That's a little bit less than an hour a week. And then it takes about 90 minutes, about every 3 weeks, to make a new pile. Not a huge labor impact. Our compost facility, when it's at full blast, would be producing about $20,000 of compost a year if we had to go out onto the open market to buy it. Usually around here, to get compost delivered is something like $100 a yard. So it adds up really quickly. And of course, there's a huge carbon footprint of moving heavy stuff all over the state. I figure we can make about $20,000 worth of compost, and we can avoid buying
$2,000 to $3,000 worth of bagged fertilizer. That's the huge upside for us.
Not to mention what the compost does for their crops.
We've seen a great increase in the productivity right out of the gate. The spinach produced 3 times what we expected it to in terms of yield per bed foot. That was just outstanding. From an economic perspective, if you could double the productivity of the land you have by applying compost, I mean, it's almost like you're getting 6 extra acres for free.
Chuck hasn't had any problems with odors bothering humans, but they have attracted critters.
We do have a resident black bear population, and of course, we've got all kinds of skunk, raccoon, possum, things like that. So the building is surrounded by electric netting, but that works really well. Addressing climate change is a really important part of this project, but also it's a big part of why I'm involved in organic farming in the first place, because I really do believe that we've got to address this carbon issue immediately, kind of all hands on deck. And this felt like an opportunity that we had to make an obvious and important difference. And it feels great to be doing this because it can be so powerless. There's so many variables that are outside of our individual control. And so this felt like, wow, I can strike a blow right here for the good teams.
Okay, but what happens if I put an orange peel in the garbage?
You go to prison. Nothing really, except possibly a reminder sticker on your garbage can.
We don't inspect residents' household trash and rip it open and look for banned items, no. But we do spot checks of loads periodically, like once or twice a year, where we go to different transfer stations and landfills and look at what's in the trash. Typically, we ask the hauler, do you know who this came from? And then we go and try and follow up directly with the generator. We just had an inspection of a facility that brought in a huge load of crackers. And so we're going to be following up with this cracker manufacturer.
How close Vermont is to reaching its 50% target won't be revealed until the waste stream content at the landfill is analyzed in 2023. All signs are pointing toward progress.
Our tonnage of diverted composted food waste has risen each and every year since 2016. So we know that people are doing the right thing, and we've also relied on some local data as some of the best evidence of what the result of the law has been. About 6 of our local governments have reported 50% or more increase in food waste separated out at their transfer stations and their composting sites. I had one of my solid waste districts send me an email and say, we had 10 tons last quarter, and this quarter I've got 19. I think they got the message, was his email. It was like, I've got more than I can handle. Thank you. So yeah, it's been impactful for sure.
So that's it, right? Yay, Vermont.
Not so fast. There's a twist in this story. No sooner did the farmers and eco-entrepreneurs get their hauling and compost operations up to speed than big multi-state corporations swooped in to snatch up their feedstock and haul it away to make biogas.
When I first started, I would walk into a supermarket and I would deal with the store manager and I would negotiate and I'd have a contract. Then it went to the store managers don't deal with trash and recycling anymore and you have to go to corporate. Things got a little bit harder because when you're talking to Albany, they don't care who you are in Hardwick, Vermont. And then the whole system shifted to big companies bidding on multi-store contracts. And then what ultimately happened, for instance, with Hannaford's,
which is a large northeastern grocery chain,
almost all of their stores are with one hauler for the whole northeast region. And I'm not saying northeast Vermont, I'm talking about the northeast U.S. We've lost all of our supermarket accounts. And for us as a small operation, that was over $100,000. That's food for our animals, which feeding animals is technically in our organics management hierarchy higher than energy production. Vermont Compost Company, a really esteemed compost producer and business in Vermont, had been receiving 2,000 tons a year of local food scraps from the Montpelier area. And in 2 weeks, they lost 100% of their tonnage. They too feed their hens on a compost forage, and they were out of feed for their flock. And 3 other farms in the central Vermont area all at once lost their material.
While not as bad as a landfill leaking methane, this is not the decentralized sustainable food system stakeholders had in mind when they wrote the law.
We were very afraid of this law industrializing and therefore downgrading the material. And we really wanted to see discarded food be upcycled and put to its highest and best use. And we even created a social contract within the legislation that directs the markets as to what the priorities are, as opposed to the other way around. And part of that, too, is also clarifying in law that food scraps and other organic materials needed to be separated from packaging and other contaminants at the point of generation.
But now those provisions are being ignored.
Aside from the fact that most of us that built this system with blood, sweat, and tears for 20 years are losing out, but beyond us, there's a potential to be engaging a lot more small producers that would result in a far more distributed system. But now that material is all tied up, and a lot of it's leaving Vermont altogether. We wrote a good piece of legislation, and it's a law that we should be proud of and we should stand behind. This is about an agency and a governor going rogue with the private sector. We have a coalition of the Conservation Law Foundation, Vermont Public Interest Research Group, Vermonters for a Clean Environment, Rural Vermont, which is a farm advocacy organization, and the Poultry Farmers for Compost Foraging, as well as a lot of other individuals and organizations that are pushing hard for legislative intervention. And so we had legislative hearings last year with both the House and Senate Natural Resource Committees. We've got an informal indication that they agree with us that the agency has gone rogue, and we'll have to see in the upcoming session what kind of action they decide to take.
So while things may not be perfect, if you take a long view, we've gone from garbage nobody wanted to people who are fighting over who gets the food waste.
That's some kind of progress. And Tom reminds us that progress happens when people and communities come together.
We did not create the climate crisis all at once, nor did any one company or any one person create it. I mean, granted, we could probably boil down to a small number of companies, but the truth is we all created this. And so it takes all of us to undo it. And what matters most and where the resilience emerges is through community. And it's not just like a make you feel better about yourself. Do what you can. It's really the true leverage is at the local level. There are definitely things that need to be addressed at a national and international policy level, but the greatest levers are the ones that are the most available to us. In this moment in time where things feel rather desperate, and it is easy to feel like every year is going to be the record-breaking year, and so why pay attention anymore? You know, we can't afford hopelessness right now, and action is the antidote to hopelessness. Your community is the canvas by which you have the most access to express ambition. We really need to get back in a place of agency as communities and start shaping our own destiny.
Next time, we'll look at biogas, its link with factory farms and communities fighting back. Thanks to our guests, Tom Gilbert, Josh Kelly, Sintana Vergara, Chuck Wooster, and Natasha Duarte. And to Dan Leibowitz, Lobo Loco, Scott Holmes, and Ketsa for our music.